This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
Welcome to Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. I'm your host, Sally Carlton. Today's topic is arms control in outer space. It's a fairly out there, excuse the pun, human rights issue, but one I'm sure that's very important to be discussing. We've got Dr. Maria Potzer, a solicitor with Les Nives, here to discuss the issue. She also happens to be one of the world's leading, actually I believe one of the world's only experts in the topic of arms control in outer space. Maria, how has it happened that one of the world's experts happens to live here in Christchurch?
Well, I actually think there's probably a few other international lawyers out there that deal with the topic of outer space, but I'm flattered by the sentiment, so thank you. I really like Christchurch a lot. There's a lot of things happening here. The technology sector is amazing. It's a great city. I wouldn't have it any other way. I really enjoy being here, and where I work at the moment, it's really, really quite fantastic. So, yeah, I haven't got a great answer for you in that respect, except for the fact that I love Christchurch. It's a really great place.
And I guess with your line of work, you could probably be doing it from anywhere, couldn't you?
In relation to law or space law?
Space law particularly.
Ah, I wonder if I could do it from Mars.
Hmm. That would definitely be testing the boundaries.
Sure.
So, Marie, could you tell us a wee bit about your background and how you got into this very specialised branch of law?
Absolutely. So I came from the UK, as you can tell from my accent. And when I came to New Zealand, I decided to undertake a Master's of International Studies. And I did that with the University of Otago under the auspices of Professor Robert Patman. And during that course, I really got a glimpse into international relations, international law, economics, and history, and these important four branches, how they relate to the world, our global world that we live in today. One of the things that we were tasked to do as part of our master's was, of course, to write a dissertation, which was part of the component. Our dissertation was 20,000 words. My dissertation project jumped a little bit from at the beginning. I wasn't entirely sure what I would write about, but I took this concept that I had to find something unique to write about really to heart. So I went off to the library and came across a couple of books on arms control and warfare. And this was a topic that we had been looking at only a few weeks before looking for topics on my dissertation research project. And I thought, well, I'm actually quite interested in that. I'd like to know a little bit more. At that time, I thought maybe I might pursue the international human rights or international humanitarian law route. Mm-hmm. So I was looking through these topics and I came across some more research into defense, aggressive uses in international law of weapons, for example, and a whole other series of international law and norms pertaining to the use of weapons and aggression at the international level. And I just came across an article that looked a little bit, just a little tiny bit, at a bilateral treaty. A bilateral treaty means a treaty between two states. And it was on the international continental ballistic missiles. So I didn't know what they were, so I researched this a little bit more, and that's how I got into space. And I realized there wasn't actually as much written about this topic as there was other things. So I thought I would write about this. So I wrote about space law, and I wrote about international relations in space, and looking at the topic of arms control. And from there, of course, a natural progression. Things just fell into place. I did a PhD, and I've been working on that topic ever since and getting into more of the commercial corporate arena of space law now.
Very interesting. So is that what you're doing in your, I guess, day-to-day job at the moment?
Well, in my day-to-day job, I am firstly and foremost a corporate lawyer. But some of my specialization that I bring with me, of course, is in this space law area. And I do a lot of work in relation to UAVs, which is unmanned aerial vehicles, or drones, as they're popularly known as. I also do a lot of technology work. We do some IT work, looking at software licensing agreements as well, and a variety of other areas of law too. But predominantly, I sit in the technology side of things within corporate law.
Great, interesting. Now, just to kick off this discussion, arms control in outer space, I think, probably seems to many people to be very removed from their day-to-day lives. But why is it that you think we should be talking about this kind of issue?
Well, making the very astute point, first of all, that this was an issue I looked at whilst undertaking my research, my PhD. At that time, we know a lot about what's going on in Antarctica. We know a lot about what's going on in the sea, but not a lot of people know what's going on in outer space. And there's a reason for that, because you can't actually see that far up into space. In fact, a lot of satellites that we have in space look down upon the Earth. So when we consider space and the utilization of space and who can use space and for what purposes, it becomes a really important aspect, because we're so reliant on space. We all have mobile phones. I use the weather service and Google Maps constantly. We're so reliant on space in our day-to-day activities for all sorts of reasons that we should probably have more of a conversation about the uses of space.
I guess how much part of our lives is space today? You've mentioned Google Maps and those sorts of apps that people use all the time, but even beyond that, and there must be television, GPS, all sorts of things that are now satellite controlled.
There's a whole range of things and that we use space for, and the reasons for using them. I wouldn't even want to sit here and start listing them off. There are far so many, but I'm sure if anyone sits down and thinks about it, we use it for all sorts of things. There are satellites up there for all different purposes and reasons. Not only that, in space we have different orbits. So, for example, if we have a satellite in the low Earth orbit, we'll be using that satellite for perhaps surveillance purposes. And that's not necessarily military surveillance. It could be commercial surveillance. Or we might use the medium Earth orbit for research, scientific research, and weather as well, looking at forecasts for the weather. The same is true for the geostationary orbit. That's a very special orbit because it rotates with the Earth as the Earth moves, or I should say as the Earth starts to rotate. And with that orbit, we can place an object or a space object on that orbit, and it will remain, to a large extent, above the geographical location upon which it's placed on the geostationary orbit. It has a really special relationship with the equator. And there's a whole bunch of other orbits as well that we can use for other purposes. So when we start to think of it in this vein, and we think of our reliance on space and space assets and how it impacts our day-to-day lives, then we do certainly need to be very much aware of how we're using space.
As these uses increase, is space also becoming increasingly important in terms of different nation states?
That's exactly right. At the moment, the geostationary orbit is fully utilized by many nation states, but it is a scarce resource. It's not ever supplying. There is only so much space. And as it becomes more crowded, I think that it's going to raise more questions and issues among nation states as to the uses, or we may have more of an exploration by commercial enterprises that wish to utilize other orbits and seek those other orbits out in order to provide similar commercial services.
That commercial element I'm really looking forward to discussing with you. I think that sounds fascinating. I did read somewhere that there's something, you know, several thousand objects floating around in space. That's obviously satellites, but it could also be rubbish from space missions and all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, I see what you mean about it's kind of a finite amount, isn't it?
Well, indeed. Space is a very, very large area. Don't misunderstand me. We're not running out of space. But as we utilize orbits more and more, and especially that special orbit, that geostationary orbit, because it has so much utility, there is now certainly a little bit more of a push towards exploring the uses of other orbits.
So how many orbits are there, as somebody who doesn't have a clue?
Well, the main ones are probably the low Earth orbit, the medium Earth orbit, the geostationary Earth orbit. There are other orbits, the high Earth orbit, the Melania orbit, but that was probably really only explored by the former Soviet Union during the Cold War. We tend to use the majority of orbits between the low Earth orbit, medium, geostationary, and perhaps a little bit towards the high Earth orbit.
Very interesting. Okay, well, we might have our first song, which was a song suggested to us by someone on Facebook, New Model Army's Space. And you'll notice as we go through that all of our songs today have a very strong outer space theme. Speak Up Korerotia. You're listening to Speak Up Korerotia, and today we're talking arms control in outer space with Maria Potza. We thought we might start this segment discussing space debris, and just what is it, and I guess how much is there?
Well, when we're talking about space debris and how much is up there, it's fair to say that there's probably a fair amount of space debris. usually when mission launches are no longer necessary, or perhaps maybe satellites are no longer needed, then they eventually will continue to orbit around the planet and find their way through to our atmosphere and burn up as they re-enter the Earth. But that can take a long time. And because it can take a long time, what we have then is these non-functional satellites or bits of space debris from missions floating about. Now, when we're trying to work out how much space debris there is in outer space, it becomes quite difficult because sometimes one piece of space debris could hit another piece of space debris and create lots of space debris. NASA has a tracking service and will track debris, but when we have collisions of that sort and then the creation of more space debris, it becomes quite difficult to track all of the debris that is floating around out there.
Yeah, and I imagine that that can cause problems for the actual functional satellites.
Absolutely. If you think that in an orbit, apart from the geostationary orbit, where the rotation is in sync with the Earth, all the other orbits have different speeds. So if you're in the low Earth orbit, you'll probably orbit the planet, the Earth, within 90 minutes. If you have a piece of space debris orbiting at that speed, then it can probably cause a little bit of damage if it comes into contact with something.
That's incredibly fast. I would have thought it would take much longer than that.
That's right. But again, it's all to do with whereabouts the actual object is placed and in which orbit that will determine the speed and the velocity upon which it's travelling.
So as you get higher up into the different orbits, do they rotate at a slower rate?
That's right. You're moving further and further away from the Earth.
Hmm. Very cool. Marie, if we're thinking about arms control, what kind of mechanisms exist in terms of governance, I suppose, of outer space? Not necessarily in terms of arms, but just generally.
When we think about arms control in outer space, the topic is actually quite a complex one. Much of the international law that governs arms control in outer space, and to be perfectly frank with you, that is probably the majority of the law that we would turn to when considering arms control, and which we will be discussing today. It's all Cold War product. So what I mean by that is during the Cold War, several important multilateral treaties were negotiated by the major powers and the superpowers during that time. Now, let me explain some of these terms a little bit to you. Multilateral means something, a treaty. Multilateral treaty means something whereby there are lots and lots of nation states who sign and choose to adhere to obligations under international law. International law is different from our own domestic law because, to some extreme, it works horizontally. Each nation state is recognized as a nation state, and how we recognize nation states or a definition of nation states is it's a very, very wide definition. But usually if one nation state recognizes another, it will trade with it. And if they trade with each other and they begin to embark on other ventures together, then there's this recognition that the other nation state is a sovereign state. And when I say sovereign, what I mean really by that is that it has territorial claim. It has self-identification. And this is certainly a conversation we can have during another interview because it's a very, very broad, wide definition. So I'm being very simplistic in when I say that nation states decide to enter into contracts together. And when you have many parties to a contract, it might become a multilateral contract. In this instance, we're certainly looking at multilateral treaties where there are many nation states that sign treaties and choose to adhere to the obligations under those treaties. When I say choose to adhere, what I mean by that is, again, that horizontal nature of international law means that states are not necessarily under the same framework that you and I as individuals are in under domestic law, whereby we must adhere to domestic law as it applies to us. So we can't park on double yellow lines, for example. But under international law, because all states are equal, because there's not really an international police force in place that will lock up the state if, for example, it breaches international law, then states are meeting at the international level on equal footing. So they're equal among each other. Again, that's certainly a conversation where whether you believe states are equal or not, that's certainly a conversation for another day. But in this extreme, when we think about treaties then, and we think about multilateral treaties, we see that there are lots of states who have signed and choose to adhere to their obligations, especially under one of the major multilateral treaties pertaining to outer space, and that's the Outer Space Treaty. The Outer Space Treaty was negotiated in 1966, to be fair, and thereafter signed and came into force through the signatories of many states in 1967. So usually we refer to it as the Outer Space Treaty 1967. And in there, under Article 4, is perhaps the major arms control provisions, which applies to those nation states that have signed and ratified the treaty to that extent. The thing that I always wonder is whether or not the principle within the Article 4 of the Outer Space Treaty has now become a customary norm. So those states that haven't necessarily signed it, would they still have to adhere to those obligations? That's a really interesting question and something that I'm thinking about at the moment. But looking at the task at hand for the purposes of our arms control today, under that international law, there are certain things that states cannot do in outer space.
Okay, so what does the treaty ban or not ban?
So under Article 4 of the Outer Space Treaty, it says that states parties to the treaty undertake not to place in orbit around the Earth any objects carrying nuclear weapons or any other kinds of weapons of mass destruction, install such weapons on celestial bodies, or station weapons in outer space in any other manner. There is another part which we'll go through, but something that I find interesting about this first part is the orbit question. But this first part really looks at treaties undertaking not to place in orbit around the Earth any objects carrying nuclear weapons. Now, it's always tricky when trying to define concepts. As a lawyer myself, I'm always hot on the topic of definitions. So when we look at nuclear weapons, we have to think to ourselves, okay, what is a nuclear weapon? In fact, there's really no definition of what a nuclear weapon is, or perhaps even a weapon. Under international law, there's no definition of a space weapon either. And when we consider this further at that second point, which says, or any other kinds of weapons of mass destruction, again, what is a weapon of mass destruction? Would it include lasers, for example? I don't really know the answers to all of these questions, but what I do know is that they instill more questions when I think about them.
Yeah.
We also have this issue of you must not install a nuclear weapon or a weapon of mass destruction on a celestial body. Well, what is a celestial body? Does it include man-made objects, or is it just natural objects, such as a meteor, for example? We must not station weapons in outer space in any other manner. Again, what does station mean? When we're looking at orbits, things are forever moving. So are we talking about just the geostationary orbit, whereby if you place something in that orbit, and because of the special relationship with the equator, the object literally stays on that point with the natural rotation of the Earth? Or can we expand that word station to lots of different orbits, even though they'll be moving around? Mm. They're not necessarily at a standstill. So already you can see some of the problems with some of the terminology here.
Are you suggesting that the legislation might be outdated? I mean, if it was written in the Cold War, that's many decades ago now.
It's a really good point that you make. The legislation is important. And at that time, it was certainly timely. But technology moves so fast. Perhaps maybe a review of the Outer Space Treaty needs to be undertaken. And maybe the adoption of some more flexible terminology needs to be incorporated. However, so far, the treaty has been working well. And so it's going to be interesting to see how technology keeps working and moving under this plane of consideration.
Definitely.
The second part of Article 4 looks specifically at the moon and other celestial bodies, and it says that they shall be used by all parties to the treaty exclusively for peaceful purposes. The establishment of military bases, installations and fortifications, the testing of any type of weapons and the conduct of military manoeuvres on celestial bodies shall be forbidden. The use of military personnel for scientific research or for any other peaceful purposes shall not be prohibited. The use of any equipment or facility necessary for peaceful exploration of the moon and other celestial bodies shall also not be prohibited. One of the issues that I have with this section is this word peaceful purposes. Again, there's no definition of what is a peaceful purpose. When does a peaceful purpose cease to be peaceful and begin to be aggressive? And again, this is a Cold War product. So back to your point that maybe the Outer Space Treaty might need a review, I would say maybe we need to do something about some of this terminology. Peaceful purposes is certainly one of those terms that could be reviewed and perhaps even a definition offered.
You mentioned that you think that the treaty is working well despite these definition difficulties. And you've also mentioned earlier that it's quite difficult to police international law, given that there's no body to do so as such. Are there any procedures or possible procedures in place if a country were to go against what they'd signed in the treaty?
In relation to the Outer Space Treaty working well, predominantly it is, but there are some key terms that need to be considered, especially in the arms control provision. When we speak of international law and states choosing to adhere to their obligations under international law, there is a lot of literature and scholarly thought on this area. States choose to adhere to international law for the sake of a peaceful world, or perhaps maybe it's in their best interests, or perhaps a whole myriad of other reasons. So when we consider when states choose not to adhere to their obligations under international law, we're certainly getting into very grey territory, in the sense that sometimes a state has to deviate from international law for its own national security interest, or sometimes the international law that might be in place might be stale in the sense of it's not flexible enough to accommodate nation states around the world who are moving in a different direction from it. So there's all sorts of reasons why states choose not to adhere to their obligations when they've signed a treaty. But when we think about international law and we think about the dynamic between states, we certainly need it to ensure at least some harmonious relationship between nation states, especially when they engage in trade with each other.
So it relies on goodwill to some degree.
To some degree.
Okay, Maria, well, we might take another break. And continuing with our space theme for songs, we've got Elton John's Rocket Man.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour. 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space. Such a timeless flight. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time till touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Again to
ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as hell, and there's no one there to raise them. If you did, I don't understand, it's just my job 5 days a week. A rocket man, a rocket man. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time till touchdown round again to find I'm not the man that think I am at home. Oh, no, 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 I'm a rocket man. Rocket man, burning out his fuse out there alone. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time till touchdown brings me round again to
to Speak Up Kōrero Tia on Plains FM 96.9. We're speaking with Maria Potza about arms control in outer space. And we've been discussing treaties and international law, and I thought it might be good to clarify what exactly do we mean by arms control. And I'm particularly thinking weaponization versus militarization, nuclear versus non-nuclear perhaps as well. And Maria, I open it up for you, your comments there.
These are all excellent concepts and questions that you ask, Sally. Really, really fantastic. Militarization is different from weaponization. The treaty itself, for example, allows for military personnel to be on the moon under Article 4 of the Outer Space Treaty 1967 for scientific research purposes. However, when we consider other purposes such as military bases or installations or fortifications or testing of any types of weapons and the conduct of military maneuvers on celestial bodies, that's forbidden. So already we can see there's a difference now between weaponization and militarization. Militarization would probably necessarily involve the military, be they there for use, as I said, just a moment ago, for scientific research, then that is permissible. But when we start to introduce that concept of weaponization with or without military attached to it, there is this prohibition in place. The thing is, though, is under the international law, we have to be very clear about what that prohibition is saying. And here we have specifically and only the moon and other celestial bodies. Well, we said before in our segment just beforehand that when we consider celestial body, what is it? Is it a man-made body? Is it a natural body? So we don't quite know what a celestial body is. We also have this any type of weapons included within that second part of the arms control provision. So whilst that seems quite wide in application, Why then has the first part of the article only prohibited the use of nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction, which we cannot orbit around the Earth? Why is there that differentiation? These are some of the things that I'm not entirely sure why we have these different points and why we have these different rules in that respect. But going back to the first premise, there is certainly a difference between militarization and weaponization. During the Cold War, it was the Soviet Union military branch that undertook much of the research, design, engineering, and exploration of space. And we all know that in 1957, the former Soviet Union was the first to arrive into space with Sputnik. So when we consider it in that way, space has probably always been militarized then. And so these are some of the concepts that are interweaved with each other, and we always have to be aware of when we're speaking about weaponization, militarization, under the auspices of arms control. And then we get into that really, really complex idea of what is arms control?
Yes, exactly. Huge, I imagine.
Indeed. And I think that's certainly a topic for another day.
I'm thinking about the role of particular countries here. We've spoken a lot about international treaties, particularly the Outer Space Treaty. But I'm wondering how those sorts of international treaties sit alongside domestic legislation. New Zealand being a prime case in point with its Nuclear Free Zone Disarmament and Arms Control Act. How do those two pieces of legislation sit alongside each other? Do they work together, or can there be tension between them?
It's a really good point that you're getting at here. New Zealand has always maintained, and will continue to do so, a reputation as a good international citizen. We abide by our international legal obligations, usually, and we always try and undertake those obligations within our domestic law. What would usually happen is, under international law, nation states will get together and sign treaties. Thereafter, through their ratification process, they will start to trickle down those obligations into their domestic law in order to make sure that they are adhering to their international legal obligations through the domestic framework. So, for example, just recently, a couple of weeks ago, the New Zealand government passed the High Altitude and Outer Space Activities Act. That's a very, very important act at this moment in time for New Zealand in relation to space. The Act in itself certainly reflects its obligations under international law, especially the Outer Space Treaty. So when we consider international law and we consider domestic law and using space as an example, that in itself gives you a flavour of how states try to be sure to adhere to their obligations from a domestic level using the domestic framework in place.
Okay, well, it's probably time for our final song. And this is a song that's pretty close to my heart. It reminds me of high school. Beastie Boys, Intergalactic.
Well, now, don't you tell me to smile. You stick around, I'll make it what you want.
listening to Speak Up Kore Rotia, and we're talking about arms control in outer space. We've been talking about some of the challenges of how do you actually implement arms control in outer space. And I thought it might be good as we finish up to think about what's the rationale for doing this. And I imagine, for example, because space is in some ways the final frontier, it's good in terms of keeping international harmony, if we could put it like that, Maria, potentially. I guess there's also environmental considerations. And that idea of space being something for all of humankind. So those are just some thoughts of mine, but I'd be really keen to hear what you've got to say.
You know, I think you have a really great outlook there. I myself like to be positive and optimistic. Some think about the Outer Space Treaty, for example. One of the first sentences says that the states parties to this treaty are inspired by the great prospects opening up before mankind as a result of man's entry into outer space.
Yeah, how wonderful
that, for
is
me,
that?
Is just, indeed, and that for me is just one of the best sentences of the treaty. It's this idea that we all cooperate, we all work together in order to go and explore and join together, you know, in order to do this. So when we think about the future of space, there's lots of things happening. Technology is advancing rapidly. We're going to be using space more and more, probably far more than we already are at the moment, and we're going to be using it for different purposes. It's quite an exciting time. We're going to see lots of new developments, and it's going to be very interesting. Back to the concept of arms control. As I said previously, there is no international treaty or law that specifically defines what a space weapon is or actually is specifically concerned with the issue of arms control in space. Something that happened in 2008 and subsequently a few years later was Russia and China got together and decided to draft and put to other spacefaring nations a treaty, a new treaty, that was titled along the lines of the Prohibition of Placing Weapons in Outer Space Treaty. The treaty, it has a far longer title than that, but just for the sake of our discussion today, I've abbreviated it. The purposes of that treaty really looked towards defining a weapon, defining an object in outer space, defining where the demarcation line is between air law and space law, because at the moment we don't know where air law ends and space law begins. There's no formal demarcation line. That in itself is quite an interesting concept, because if we look at some of our activities under air law, activities fall under the auspices of the nation state. So if you're in an aeroplane and an aeroplane wishes to cross boundaries over one nation state to another, it must ask permission to do so. Whereas under space law, because space is for the benefit of mankind, and it comes under this concept of it is for everyone and owned by no one, then we start looking at space in a different way. So whereas air law is certainly a framework that must adhere to both international and domestic obligations, space law is a little bit different. We must adhere to obligations under international law, certainly, but whether or not your nation state has a domestic piece of legislation in place is another story. Now, New Zealand, as I said, just recently passed the Space Act, which is great, but these are certainly ideas and concepts which will require more development and more discussion and more thinking about as we progress into the future and when we think about space. When we look at the PPWT, that's the Prohibition of Placing Weapons in Outer Space Treaty that was tabled by China and Russia, in there it was really, really quite a forward-thinking document. It defined these key terms. It looked at a whole series of other issues as well. Whilst that hasn't yet become a treaty in its own right and is only in draft form, it certainly is something towards grounding greater foundation to the concept of arms control.
What do you think is the likelihood of that treaty or that draft treaty progressing?
I'm an optimist. I like to think it's going to go through, and eventually it will become a very solid piece of international law. I'm still optimistic about that, but we go back to that argument that the Outer Space Treaty 1967 has and continues to work in its present form. So why introduce something new? Something that I really like about this new treaty is this idea of definition of concepts. If perhaps we could take that stance and define some of these key concepts within the Outer Space Treaty, then that would certainly aid the Outer Space Treaty in bringing it, I don't want to say up to date, that's the wrong word, but certainly to make it more flexible to the development of technology that happens every single day around the world. Technology waits for no law. It continually advances. It continually progresses.
I think that's a fantastic quote, technology waits for no law.
Thank you.
With the recent negotiations at the UN on nuclear weaponry, was there anything in there that mentioned space?
Not that I'm aware of. There could have been some mention, but I would understand that the principle under Article 4 that states must not place in orbit around the Earth nuclear weapons would still remain. I cannot see that being something that nation states would agree to diminish or get rid of. It's a very fundamental point. That's one of those things that I mentioned at the very beginning of our discussion, whether or not some of these concepts would move into customary law. Customary international law is law that is, it's necessarily unwritten, but states do this anyway. They act in a certain way, in a customary way, and they continue to do it. And that's how much of the law of the sea was developed. Much of the international law of the sea was developed on that basis of customary law, because nation states began to act in certain ways and began to use same signalling, for example, and other means as well, recognising certain principles. So prohibiting the placement in orbit around the Earth any objects carrying nuclear weapons or any other kinds of weapons of mass destruction seems to me to be one of those principles that will necessarily translate into customary international law. And so I don't think there's any change in that respect at those talks.
That's heartening. And just as we finish up, have we got any final comments potentially on the direction you see space law developing in terms of arms control?
I'm always so optimistic when it comes to international law of arms control. I always truly believe that international law will adopt, will change, will reflect the changing global needs of our world. So I'm optimistic that we're going to see some more changes.
Towards the better, no doubt.
Indeed.
Excellent. Well, Maria, I'd like to thank you very much. It's really quite fascinating, this stuff, something that I'm sure many of the listeners have possibly never even thought about before. It's definitely slightly off-planet, and that's another pun, so excuse that one. Listeners, don't forget, we have our Facebook page and Twitter page, so we can stick up some resources, potentially information around the recent legislation New Zealand's passed, for example. And don't forget, all our shows are transcribed. Catch you next time, guys. And Maria, thanks again very much.
Thank you.